From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and there's lots going on today. We've been watching relations warming up between the U.S. and Cuba, something people of a certain age thought they'd never see. But today in the Rose Garden, President Obama spoke about reopening the U.S. embassy in Havana.
And, of course, we're following events in Greece after that default yesterday on a payment to the International Monetary Fund. Today, the Prime Minister, Alexis Tsipras, vowed to push on with his plan for a referendum on the country's debt crisis that's set for this weekend. Tsipras also apparently offering some concessions to Greece's creditors, but European officials ruled out any deal before the vote, the referendum this Sunday. Also, Robin, some pretty striking tweets coming out of the prime minister's office. He said, "You're being blackmailed." He's talking to the Greek people. "You're being blackmailed and urged to vote yes to all of the institution's measures without any solution to exiting the crisis." He also said, "There are those who say that I have a hidden agenda, that with an ohi or no vote, I'll take Greece out of the EU. They are flat out lying to you." Meanwhile, the European Commission tweeting, "Greece is Europe. Europe is Greece."
It's quite remarkable to see a prime minister, exacting policy and trying to
tweeting
urge
like that,
things on
trying
tweets.
To keep his people behind him. Journalist John Syropoulos writes the blog The New Athenian, joins us from Athens. And John, what are you hearing about the negotiations that are going on between Greece and its creditors?
Well, the prime minister has just addressed the nation, saying that he's going to go ahead with the referendum on Sunday. He's explained that the no vote he wants is not a vote that would take Greece on a course out of the euro, but that would signal Greeks' resistance to austerity within the euro. He wants, he says, a Europe that is more visionary, one that doesn't walk hand in hand with financial institutions. He wants to turn a new page for democracy, in his words. Now, that, of course, is something, that referendum is something that Greece's creditors are also waiting for, because I think, according to the vote, they will decide on how well disposed they are to extend further credit and to come back to the negotiating table. As you know, Greece is now no longer in a financial arrangement, so everything essentially has to be agreed from scratch.
And as you look at the protests on the streets, and we know that there was a big no vote protest against the bailout in Syntagma Square a couple days ago, and then yesterday there was the big yes vote protest. What are you expecting? Do you think the Greek people are going to say yes or no to this?
Well, it's shifting. I think there was more of a no vote over the weekend when it was announced, but the latest poll figures we've seen today in a government-friendly newspaper show that that's fallen by about 10 points to roughly 46%. The yes vote has risen by a few points to 37%. It's still behind, but the trend is upward. So there could be an upset of the no majority by next Sunday. The campaigning, of course, still goes on by both sides, and it's deeply polarized people here. A lot of people feel that this is essentially a referendum on the government, and that a yes vote will be, in effect, a popular censure that will bring it down. I would not be at all surprised if that is what Greece's creditors are hoping for, because they've insisted the referendum take place, perhaps hoping that it will trigger a fall of this government. A no vote, of course, doesn't leave the government in a particularly good position either, because it is really up to their creditors' discretion to extend a renewed offer. The European Central Bank may decide to keep banks closed and capital controls in place, which will further stress the Greek economy. The European Stability Mechanism, which is a sort of governmental distress fund set up by Eurozone governments, which the Greeks have asked to essentially offer them bankruptcy protection over the next 2 years by picking up their debt as it comes due, a sort of moratorium on debt payments. The ESM does not operate under the authority of the separate governments. It operates under the authority of the European Commission. And the European Commission is at this point deeply offended at the stance of the Greek government. There's no guarantee, therefore, that after a no vote or a yes vote, the Greeks on Monday will have their creditors coming up to them to shake their hands and come to a new arrangement.
And John Syropoulos, what are things like right now in Athens for ordinary people who have now had to deal with many days of only being able to withdraw €60 out of ATMs. We know that ATMs have been running out of money in some places. A lot of retirees don't even have the cards that they need to put in the ATM, so they've had to make extra measures for them and open up banks so that they can get some money out. But what are things like on the ground?
Well, people, you know, are very worried about the cash availability problems. This hasn't happened in recent decades, at least. It's not something that has happened within living memory. So the Greeks are feeling a mixture of bad things. One is embarrassment that they've brought themselves to this purse. Another is consternation over whether they'll be able to cover their material needs for the coming days. And some, of course, anger towards the government for botching its negotiating strategy so badly and for backtracking or flip-flopping, if you like, because today the government is revealed to have gone back to creditors and said, yes, we will take the last offer that was on the table with a few minor changes if you would please agree to reopen negotiations with us. It is an embarrassing and humiliating point, I would say, in Greek history, and it's not one of which people are generally proud of, and that is mixing up with their own personal worries about their survival in the coming days.
Journalist John Syropoulos in Athens, he writes the blog The New Athenian. John, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, to Oregon now, where Oregon's recreational marijuana users are using it legally for the first time today. Last night, supporters gathered on Portland's Burnside Bridge to count down the seconds to midnight when the law went into effect.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1,
go! Oregon is the latest state to allow recreational marijuana use, and as the industry grows, so does its political clout. For members of Congress who are constantly fundraising, the cannabis industry offers new high-yield donors, but it also raises questions about the money's source and what those donors expect in return. Conrad Wilson from Here and Now contributor Oregon Public Broadcasting reports.
It was a classic political fundraiser, semi-formal, with chicken, potatoes, and salad on the menu. 300-plus donors sipped gin cocktails and Oregon Pinots in Portland early last month.
I don't know if giddy is exactly the right word, but I think everyone felt really grown up.
Amy Margolis is a Portland attorney and founder of the Oregon Cannabis PAC. The marijuana-backed political action fund hosted the fundraiser for Oregon's Democratic Congressman Earl Blumenauer.
People that I've been working with, in some cases for years, dealing with trying to modernize our marijuana laws, came together and they threw me a little party. It was great fun.
Fun indeed. The event raised more than $100,000 for Blumenauer's reelection. Margolis says that's the largest sum ever contributed by the cannabis industry to a politician during a single event. According to data analyzed by the Center for Responsive Politics, the cannabis industry nationwide has donated more than $400,000 to members of Congress and federal candidates since 2002. The Pot PAC represents a newly energized group. They're members of the cannabis industry, now in an era where their product is legal for recreational use.
As the marijuana industry scales up, you'll see a growing legislative presence.
Todd Donovan is a political science professor at Western Washington University.
Right now, you've kind of seen it go from a small lobby group that was about legalization to a more, you know, mature industry that's affected by state taxes, state regulations, local regulations about where you can open stuff.
Neighboring Washington State will mark its first year of recreational pot sales at about the same time Oregon gets ready to enter that market. So far, Washington's retail marijuana stores have exceeded $250 million in sales. Of that, more than $60 million is tax revenue.
The amounts have been relatively small in comparison with more established industries. However, they are increasing over time.
That's Peter Quist, a research director at the National Institute on Money and State Politics. By comparison, the beer, wine, and liquor industry contributed more than $10 million to members of Congress and candidates just in the 2014 election cycle. That's according to data analyzed by the Center for Responsive Politics.
This industry doesn't give a lot in the grand scheme of things. However, its giving is increasing over time. So it's giving more now than it used to. And that is reflective of a new industry kind of coming onto the scene here.
Back in Oregon, organizers of the fundraiser for Earl Blumenauer say the purpose of the gathering was to thank him for his efforts in Congress. But it was also an opportunity to showcase what cannabis donors can do for supportive politicians.
We are willing to come out for you if you support us.
That's Amy Margolis again, founder of the Oregon Cannabis Pack. As for where the industry's contribution money comes from, she says it's all above board.
The voters in Oregon have overwhelmingly supported the adult use market. We've had the medical market since 1998. And I don't see any reason that a legislator from a state that has so overwhelmingly supported this shouldn't be able to take that money.
Margolis says right now the industry wants access to banking services and a change in federal law to allow businesses selling pot to be eligible for tax exemptions. And Congressman Blumenauer, he seems on board with that.
They should have a bigger political footprint because it's insane that the federal government interferes with doing things like having a bank account or being treated fairly in the tax system.
Earlier this year, Blumenauer introduced legislation that would tax and legalize marijuana at the federal level. For Here and Now, I'm Conrad Wilson in Portland.
Can we make brains smarter? People already use drugs and enhancing technology to heal the brain. But in her Atlantic article, Hacking the Brain, journalist Maria Konnikova looks at the methods scientists are using or hoping to use to make minds more powerful. She joins us now. So, Maria, we all do things that affect the brain.
Absolutely. I mean, Robin, have you had a cup of coffee today?
Well, I get my caffeine cold, but yeah.
Well, there you go. So caffeine is a cognitively enhancing drug.
Yeah, there it is. And there's also drugs like Ritalin that are being used.
Yes, absolutely. So there are lots of drugs, Ritalin, modafinil, which is used for narcolepsy and sleep disorders, were developed with therapeutic purposes in mind, are now being used off-label, so to speak, to try to get people smarter. So people take Ritalin now in college, for instance, to concentrate, to improve their memory, to improve their retention. Modafinil makes people go longer. It's being used by the U.S. military, in fact, to try to see what they can do to make their soldiers be able to function for longer at a higher capacity.
Well, let's back up a second, because before even more college students run to take Ritalin, which is prescribed for people with ADHD and narcolepsy, and use it to stay up to take a test, there are side effects. And that's sort of a small reminder of the downside of all of this cognition enhancement.
Absolutely. I mean, none of this is, you know, the smart pill. For instance, Ritalin specifically might improve your attention span and make you be able to stay up later for that assignment, but it also impacts your creativity. So you might not be able to connect ideas quite as well. You definitely won't have that sort of insight into, you know, if you're trying to write a paper and you want to have an insightful argument, that might not happen with Ritalin.
There's the same kinds of side effects with other drugs. But the point
yes.
is that when scientists see that we can do something with a drug, we can impact the brain with a drug, they are looking forward to maybe, you know, personalizing things and taking away some of these side effects. Give us the overarching here. There's a saying that you quote that human beings only use 10% of their brain power. Is that true, by the way?
That isn't true. No. So I quote it as one of the myths that we like to adhere to so that we have this blue sky ahead of us that we can make ourselves smarter. But the truth is we use all of our brains. We don't necessarily use everything as efficiently. We can develop certain parts of the brain. We can form new connections, but we do use the whole brain. It's just a question of efficiency, of training, of effectiveness.
Right. And that's what people are researching right now. When you spoke about drugs, you spoke to a neuroscientist at MIT mm-hmm. who says that, you know, some biotech companies are looking to personalized drugs.
Yeah, this is Guoping Fang, and he was telling me about some fascinating research about basically people who use what we are now learning about the human genome to then in the future be able to give you a personalized medicine. We can say, okay, it looks like, you know, you're a very creative person, but your memory is lacking. So let me give you something that's going to affect that one particular thing and to make you the best possible version of you. This is something that people are working towards.
And there are a lot of questions about it. We'll get to some of those. But you set off on a journey to learn what else is going on and started with sort of electronic stimulation. And you tried it. Now, we know about electroshock therapy. So what's different now?
So this is called transcranial direct current stimulation. And what that means is you basically put little jolts of current through your brain at specific points in your brain. And depending on where you put electrodes on your head, the strength of the electric current and the interval between the different currents, you get to create different sorts of brain patterns. So what I tried was a do-it-yourself type of electronic stimulation. There's a company called Think, THYNC, actually based in Boston, trying to create this device that, you know, you can send out to your home. So far, they only have two different vibes, they call them. One is called calm and one is called energize. And those things have cognitive side effects as well. And by side effects, I actually mean good side effects. So when you're calmer, you're able to, you know, reflect, you're able to focus more. When you're energized, that gives you kind of the same type of jolt that you'd get with caffeine, but it actually can last longer. We know some of these things last for up to 2 hours after the fact. You know, a few years ago, this was still just being tested in the lab, and people weren't quite sure if it was safe or not.
Well, now it's been tested on 3,000 people, including you, and you are maybe a cautionary tale because you wanted the calming jolt, but instead you got this electric shock and the sort of, oops, you know, software problem. But I mean, I would think that that would be one of the concerns, strapping things onto your head.
Well, honestly, you know, I tested it for the sake of science and journalism. And what happened was 3 electric shocks to the head, kind of very one flew over the cuckoo's nest like, and it hurt. And they told me, oh, we're so sorry. This was defective. Why don't you try it again? But to be quite honest, after that had happened several times, I had no desire to try it again.
Well, and also, I look just at that, mild shocks to the head for some calming or a little bit of a jolt that might last a half an hour, as you said, a cup of coffee. Mm-hmm. Why not do yoga for the calm and run a half a mile for the jolt?
You are absolutely right. And to be perfectly honest, the data we have for things like that far surpasses the data for any single cognitive enhancing technology that we currently have. So the best things you can do are sleep, exercise, eat right, things that you would normally do for a healthy lifestyle. Those are the types of things that are going to enhance your cognition above and beyond anything like the current stimulation to your head.
And yet, if you have a problem like Parkinson's, deep brain stimulation, electrodes that are put inside your brain, deep in there where the think electrodes can't reach, can maybe help with depression and with other related illnesses.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, therapeutically, deep brain stimulation, we're just in its infancy and already we're seeing huge impacts. People who've been depressed for decades, for whom nothing has worked, for whom basically life has not been worth living, are suddenly seeing themselves reawakened. And people with Parkinson's, their symptoms are controlled, their tremors are controlled. And this is being tested in more and more diseases. So when it's used correctly for what it was developed for therapeutic purposes, this is really a beautiful technology. But people even want to use deep brain stimulation where you have, you know, that is open brain surgery. You get electrodes inserted inside your head. People want to use that for cognitive enhancement.
Well, look down the road, because electrodes are one thing, but people are considering chips put directly in the head that would link directly to the internet.
Yes, this is something that a team at Oxford University is looking at. They have this dream that everyone will be always connected to the internet and potentially even to each other. So you can even go a step further. And what if your chip were connected to someone else's chip and you could kind of get a collective brain power? And on the one hand, you can see why someone would want a chip in their brain. It's like instant memory, instant internet. You have all of this information at your disposal. On the other hand, you know, it's the same as with all these technologies. If we're having privacy concerns about the NSA checking on our phones and our emails, imagine what happens when we now have brain chips in our head and the government, you know, medical institutions, whoever it is, has access to that data.
Well, and that brings us to maybe the most controversial approach to this, as you write, neuroenhancement. Not stimulating the brain, but re-engineering it. We know so much about the human genome now. There's miraculous ways that an embryo's genome could be altered to fight disease. But then what if you can identify genes associated with being smart and manipulate them?
There is now, for the first time, a technology that's being developed at Harvard and MIT that can take one single gene and change it before someone is even born, at least in theory. That's what we can do. And people are thinking, oh, well, why can't we just do this to create super people? Why can't I, you know, have a designer baby? And I think that is a long way off because intelligence is incredibly complicated and there's no such thing as a smart gene. I mean, there are lots of genes that interact with each other and they have a different function at different points in our development. So that's a very distant possibility, but we're going to have to figure out a lot more before we can do that.
Well, the ethical questions, would the very rich then be able to afford tinkering with an embryo and be the only ones to afford to put the smart genes in if you find them? How would physicians determine who would use these inventions? A lot of ethical questions remain. But you found great excitement.
I did find great excitement, despite the ethical concerns. But the funny thing is, the biggest concern, at least for now, we're not even at the ethics yet. It's a question of health, because we don't actually know what will happen to us in the long term if we do manage to rev our brains up. Our brains have been enhanced over millennia. And so what if they're already running as they should be, and if we make them try to run more efficiently, faster, become better at something, what is the long-term effect? Are we going to die sooner? Are we going to get dementia sooner? All of these health questions, we haven't answered those yet.
Maria Konnikova, her article in The Atlantic is Hacking the Brain. She's also author of Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes, and the forthcoming Confidence Game. Maria, thank you so much for talking to us about this and for allowing yourself to be a guinea pig.
Thank you so much for having me, Robin.
Let's check in on Puerto Rico, where the power company has reached a deal today with creditors, giving it until September to negotiate its debt. But that was just part of the money Puerto Rican borrowers owe by the end of today to avoid default. Ann Krieger co-authored a report on the debt crisis in Puerto Rico. She's a former official with the World Bank and the IMF. Ann Krieger, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. Good to be here.
And how bad is the situation in Puerto Rico, as you found in your report?
It's bad. They've had almost no economic growth in a long time. There are a lot of problems. A lot of people are leaving for the mainland. Participation of the labor force is only about 40%, contrasted with more than 60% here on the mainland. But while it's bad now, the problems are there's enough overhang of debt and financial and other issues that unless they do something, it's going to get a lot worse.
A lot worse in what way? That more people would just continue to leave or what?
The government has tried to offset the failure to grow by thinking that it was a recession, and they've, of course, spent to do that, and they financed a lot of that spending by accumulating debt. Well, of course, debt builds up over time, and they're getting close to if they are not at the point where they can't borrow anymore, in which case the government will have to cut back. And on present policies, which, of course, can't continue, they would indeed basically run out of cash. And then, of course, the government would have to shut down, and this is certainly not something that could be contemplated, so there'd be a big cut back in some government expenditures and so on with huge ramifications.
Well, what is the root cause of this? Why is the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico so much worse off than any city like Detroit or any state in the United States?
Well, first off, it's not a state. It is,
right,
of course, a territory of the United States. And it's subject to some U.S. laws which help it and some which hurt it. The ones that hurt it are, have hurt it, I think, is that Puerto Rico is subject to U.S. minimum wage laws, and yet it's competing with other Caribbean islands, which have, of course, much lower wages. And basically, the minimum wage covers about 80% of the workforce in Puerto Rico, contrasted with 27% in the U.S., i.e., U.S. wages are high enough that the same minimum wage protects the bottom but not the rest in Puerto Rican cases than otherwise. And so a lot of people have just left and gone to the mainland for work. There was, in the 1970s, Puerto Rico was given a huge tax advantage for American companies that located there. And they had, by the way, a good boom during that period in a lot of companies, some of which left after 1996 when their tax treatment was removed. So some of it has been the result of earlier largesse, which then went away, and some other things. And there's been a lot that the Puerto Ricans have done to themselves, which have made the situation even worse.
What can be done about this at this point?
Well, first stuff. I think it isn't any one thing, and there's a lot that Puerto Ricans can do. You can't take care of the financial mess without restoring growth, and you can't restore the economic growth without taking care of the financial mess. You've got to work on all fronts. We think there are things that need to be done to make it easier to do business in Puerto Rico, easier to hire labor in Puerto Rico. We think that the absence of Chapter 9 of the U.S. Bankruptcy Code applying to Puerto Rico hurts it and is probably unwarranted.
Well, do you think that the Congress is going to listen to you on that and allow Puerto Rico to file for Chapter 9 bankruptcy protection?
I don't know what they'll do, but I think as an American citizen, it seems to be only reasonable that there has to be some way out for the Puerto Ricans. I mean, the alternative is really trying to negotiate at a big disadvantage and, as I said, with real financial threats.
Ann Krieger, who co-authored a report on Puerto Rico's debt crisis for the Puerto Rican government. She's a professor of international economics at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Ann Krieger, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Say, American songbook and very specific names come to mind. Gershwin, Porter, Irving Berlin, all great contributors to America's soundscape. But those are only a few threads in the grand patchwork that is American music. We've been taking an occasional deeper look at that patchwork, asking people in music, what do they think of when they think American music? Is it Nina Simone? Is it Woody Guthrie? Today we're asking Joy Williams. Born and raised just outside Santa Cruz, California, she was half of the Grammy-winning duo The Civil Wars with musical partner John Paul White. The Civil Wars disbanded last year. Joy's new album is called Venus. We're going to hear a little of that, but first, her picks. Joy Williams, welcome.
Thanks, Robin. How are you?
I'm good. And we're excited about hearing what you think of when you think of American music. Come up with a sample.
Oh, goodness. I feel like it was a really difficult thing to come up with a list because my list went so long and deep and wide. You know, you mentioned the greats and the classics, but to me as well, there's Billie Holiday needs to be included in that. Mm-hmm. I grew up listening to her my whole life, and
really?
I still put her on when I'm cooking dinner or if I'm driving and stuck in LA traffic, like I seem to be a lot more these days. And I just love, she has a song called Them Their Eyes that I just feel like encapsulates, I don't know, sort of the, even though it wasn't recorded in the 1920s, I don't think, it sort of captures that sort of roaring 20s, this sort of carefree time before a harder time happened in life. But
right.
I always loved that she had an ache even when she was singing something sweet.
Well, let's listen to a little of Billie Holiday's version of Them Their Eyes, recorded by Holiday in 1949. Let's listen.
With you the first time I looked into them their eyes, and you have a certain little cute way of flirting with them their eyes.
You know, you're right, Joy, that is American.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Very much. I mean, can't you just imagine a dance hall just filled with people in beautiful clothes? And I just always love the way she sings, and there's a confidence with her, you know, especially as a woman in that day and age, she really found a way to carve her own niche and even get a little controversial at times, too, which I like that in a woman.
Well, and that brings us to your next selection. Let's listen, 1970, Janis Joplin's Mercedes-Benz.
Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime. No help from my friends. So, oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? Oh,
from Lord, the stories that I was told, like, she was just a... like a firestorm everywhere that she went. And I think what I love the most about the song is that I think in a way this song sort of sums up this capitalist idea of I'm working hard and I would like my life to, you know, to evidence that. And I've always just, I think it's such a great tongue-in-cheek way of almost kind of blending this like church song feel with a front porch attitude, and also a little bit of that tongue-in-cheek of her sort of even, playing with the idea of that a Mercedes-Benz would somehow be, you know, the epitome of making it.
So, very American sound there to you, Joy Williams. Your next choice, let's listen. This is Alabama Shakes, Gimme All Your Love.
So much is going on, but you can always come around.
Joy, what are you hearing here? I'm hearing Motown. I'm hearing everything here.
Everything. I mean, you hear jazz, you hear blues, you hear Motown. I mean, I even hear a little bit of Billie Holiday in some of her jazz vocal approach and how she's doing it. But then if you listen onto that song, she literally is like yelling at you and me to give, you know, give me all your love. I just love that there is a total embrace of this sound that they've created that feels very historic and yet also modern to me at the same time. And then isn't it always the American way to take what you have and then try and make it bigger or build off of that?
Brittany Howard from Alabama Shakes, another pick from Joy Williams. All right, let's set up this last pick from you. It's a voice not everyone might know, but you might have heard his work. It's Chris Stapleton. He's written for Kenny Chesney, George Strait, Tim McGraw, Adele. This is his own performance, Whiskey and You.
Come tomorrow, I can walk in the store, it ain't a problem. And they'll always sell me more, but your forgiveness, well, that's something I can't buy. There ain't anything that I can do. That's the difference between whiskey and you.
I love the way Chris writes. In this song in particular, he almost speaks the what we would call the hook, you know, what we songwriters would call the hook. I mean, that's the difference, I think, between whiskey and you. And I'd love, it's harkening back to a different era of music, and it's, I hear Hank Williams, and I hear, you know, in that aching, in that way of talking about a bottle, and I think that also, I hear Waylon Jennings a lot in this too, you know, almost mountain songs, you know, where it feels very much rooted to the earth. And maybe not always flattering, but that's not a bad thing. It's so innately human that you can hear yourself in the song, too.
Well, Joy Williams, again, formerly of the Civil Wars, now this Grammy-winning musician is out with her new solo album, Venus. Pick one cut for us that, you know, in which we can hear the American songbook.
Oh, interesting. I think, I don't know, there's like a few I feel like I could pick, but there's one song that's coming to mind for me where I've read an ancient tradition where women go off into the forest when they find out that they're pregnant, and they wait until they find a melody that they can attribute to the child, that becomes the child's theme song. I always loved that idea. But when I was pregnant with my son, Miles, I was on the road so much that I didn't feel like I even had a chance to hear that melody. So he was born, and in my arms, in the screened-in back porch of my house in Nashville, and I just remember holding him, just pink and smelling so beautiful, like newborns do, and all of a sudden, this melody came to me, which does not happen very often, and I saved it on my phone.
Well, and which song is this?
Sweet Love of Mine.
When you found me, I was all alone.
And then when the time came to write for this record, this melody came back to me. And there's a hint of an Appalachian feel. There's a hint of sort of the American song writing, in that it's a classic form of writing. And yet I did something a little bit different in the second verse, which I like to think is, I don't know, my own way of interpreting the classic song, songwriting in this American age.
Joy, thanks for sharing your playlist with us.
Yeah, thanks for listening. I had a good time talking to you.
Thousands of people will travel to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania this week to mark the 152nd anniversary of the bloodiest battle of the Civil War. They'll come to stand in the battlefield's most storied places like Little Round Top or Devil's Den and imagine the loss those landscapes witnessed. Until recently, that experience could be hard to get to because of how dramatically the land was altered in the decades after the battle, but that's changing, as Lou Bluen from WESA in Pittsburgh reports.
Even more than 150 years after the battle, there's still plenty at Gettysburg that kind of makes you feel like you're stepping back in time. If you really want to go the extra mile, you can even do a battlefield tour in a horse-drawn carriage. Katie Lawhon prefers to walk the battlefield. She's been a park ranger here for more than 20 years, and you can still hear the excitement in her voice when she hikes some of the most legendary places on the battlefield.
So we're at Devil's Den. And this is important ground because we have heavy fighting on the second day of the battle. General Hood attacked nearly a mile of open ground uphill against this position, and they took it.
Devil's Den was one of the more dramatic landscapes at Gettysburg in July 1863. It was a sloped open field strewn with giant boulders. Soldiers would have used these rocks for temporary cover as they made their attacks. But by the 1990s, the whole area had grown up into a wall of trees. Lawhon says park rangers had to use historic photos to show tourists what it used to look like.
And a lot of people who studied the battlefield, they just walked down into those trees. They tried to walk in the footsteps of the soldiers, and they would do it. It was just a lot harder to understand.
So in the late 1990s, the National Park Service started toying with a pretty radical idea. What if they rehabilitated the natural landscape at Gettysburg to look like it did in 1863? In places of heavy fighting like the peach orchard, they'd replant peach trees. And the meadows that had grown over into forest, well, those new trees would get the axe. And the Park Service did it over the course of about 15 years.
We're very careful about what we do, and we base it on historic evidence and studies. But at the same time, I mean, our job is to preserve and maintain these battlefield features. We can't be so in awe of the Gettysburg battlefield that we keep our hands off of it.
In all, the Park Service rehabbed more than 500 acres of the battlefield's most significant spots. They also removed man-made structures, including a motel, a nine-hole golf course, and even their own visitor center, which the Park Service plopped down in the 1960s at a key point on the Union Line. Most of the heavy work is done now, but maintaining the battlefield's new look might prove to be an even bigger challenge. Head landscaper Randy Hill walks up a rocky hillside called Little Round Top. For historical accuracy, he actually has to maintain a clear cut that was done here just before the battle.
For the area of Little Round Top, if you were a single person working with a single handsaw, it would probably take you a whole entire summer to keep this area maintained and clear. And then the next spring, you'd have volunteer woody vegetation popping right back up, and you'd be right back at it again.
Some natural details on the battlefield are more authentic than others. The historical cluster of trees that was the focal point for Pickett's charge actually doesn't have any 1863 trees left in it. Randy Hill just trims the trees that are here now to the right shape and size. But one set of details the Park Service wants to make sure they get exactly right is minimizing the environmental impact of the battlefield rehab. Zach Belai, though, manages natural resources at Gettysburg.
We knew that we wanted to remove up to 500 acres of wooded habitat, and we said, well, we'll never do it in any one portion of the park all at once. So the thought process is that things will have the opportunity to adapt as we change the landscape.
Belai, though, says in places like Devil's Den, they decided to leave some non-historic trees when they found out they were home to a pair of nesting black vultures. And they mow fields as little as possible, and then only after Gettysburg's birds are finished nesting. The Park Service has even started using fire to mimic the way nature would regenerate all the open meadows that are again a part of the Gettysburg landscape.
The Slider Field was our first 13-acre test burn, and It was a pretty good success. It was a success being that it was the first time we did it. And people accepted the fact that Gettysburg could burn and not burn down a cultural resource.
All in all, they've done a pretty good job, according to Randy Wilson, a professor of environmental science at Gettysburg College and an expert on public lands management. Wilson says it's also important to remember that Gettysburg is a national military park whose primary mission is protecting the historical values of the battlefield.
So their efforts to try to intervene and say, look, there can also be a place where we can protect the environment, you know, I think that's a very important step that they've taken.
Wilson says evaluating whether the ongoing rehab at Gettysburg is a good thing for the park will take some time. He points out that visitation numbers at national parks are down across the board, so it's unclear whether the battlefield rehab will make Gettysburg more of a destination. But 28-year-old Kyle Beeger, who's here on a road trip from Missouri, says the new look of the battlefield makes all the difference.
The feeling you get here, you know, just a bit surreal. It's like, you know, we were just thinking earlier, it's like, you know, imagine all the cannon fire, what it was like to be here. It's hard to explain, but it's incredible.
For Here and Now, I'm Lou Bluin in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.